You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today is Monday, February 2nd, 2026. I'm here with Professor Bill Easterly of New York University. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this is the last month of the 2025 season. We had the great pleasure of having Bill come and give a talk on his new book, Violent Saviors, which was a great way for our PPE workshop to end the year. And today I have a great opportunity to delve a little deeper into the book with Bill. So Bill, why don't we just start by telling us how it is that you came to write Violent Saviors?
Yeah, I think it came out of a lot of frustration that's been building for a long time, watching the development world. I was really struck by how any sort of regime that led to a rapid economic growth, as measured by GDP per capita growth, was presumed to be benevolent. You know, it could be China, it could be Rwanda, it could be Ethiopia. And, you know, those rulers were called benevolent autocrats. And it's like all the weight is for measuring well-being is put on GDP per capita, and nothing on, you know, whether people are oppressed, whether they're denied freedom. So there's sort of like zero weight on freedom and 100% weight on GDP per capita. And that didn't seem quite right to me.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of debate on this, and I think the other side's been winning that debate. So I thought, you know, maybe I could look for help to some guys who'd written about this before, beginning with a person named Adam Smith two hundred fifty years ago. And, you know, it struck me that the classical liberals very much, you know, analyze this problem of when there is material increases in well-being, but a denial of freedom, how do we think about that?
Yeah.
And they specifically commented on another kind of benevolent autocrat, which were the colonial autocrats, who, you know, often promised that they were bringing material benefits to the people that they were colonizing. And the classical liberals responded to that. And that's what really inspired this whole book. It's like the colonizers were saying, we're going to conquer you for your own good. That's kind of the essence of, I call that the development right of conquest.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to, as long as we bring material development, we have a right to conquer you, and it's actually for your own good. So we conquer you for your own good.
So in the beginning of the book, you contrast Condorcet and Smith in this. I think you might have actually been even able to use Mill, though it's of a later period. But Mill argued that liberty was maybe not fit for everyone if you were a backward culture or something like that. But nevertheless, the Smith Condorcet discussion. Could you give some examples of what Condorcet was on one side and Smith on the other side?
Yeah, so Condorcet is very much of the modern development mindset. He actually envisioned kind of a graph where there'd be a strong upward trend. He didn't know the concept of GDP per capita, but he definitely had some idea of material well-being brought by the conquerors. And so he's very much in the we conquer you for your own good school. And even more dramatic, he analyzed different groups that were being conquered and thought some of them would actually disappear as a result of the conquest, and yet somehow it was still for their own good. And Adam Smith, you know, what's interesting about Adam Smith is he does not choose to argue with Condorcet or to take another debate. He doesn't argue with slave owners that when they claim that they are bringing material benefits to their slaves. We'll come back to that later. And so the debate between Smith and Condorcet is not about, you know, the empirical scientific proposition of which is better for raising GDP per capita, you know, colonialism or leaving them alone. That's not what the debate is about. It's interesting that Smith actually thought that the American colonies were like the ideal situation for rapid material growth. There was lots of land available, relative freedom for the colonial subjects of European origin. And yet, despite that, he described the, here's a quote that I like from Smith. He described what he called, quote, the savage injustice of the Europeans, and said that this had been ruinous and destructive to several of these unfortunate colonies. And since he already said, you know, he thought material GDP was increasing rapidly, what he meant by ruinous and destructive was about their freedom, about the justice of what had happened to them. And so Smith saw this very much as what we would today call a normative debate, or maybe to put it in easier language, just a moral debate between whether the conquest was just, and which is Condorcet's view, justice follows material GDP. So as long as, you know, the conquerors bring more material GDP, then it was just. And Smith said, oh, no, no, not quite. If you bring material GDP, but you force your increases in well-being on the people you're conquering, then, you know, they haven't actually consented to this supposed increase in their well-being. And that, for Smith, is determinative. You know, if you don't consent, then you're not better off. And it's unjust. If it's forced on you, you don't consent.
One of the things that I found very appealing in your book, as you might suspect, is that a lot of people who are critics of, let's call it, this emphasis on GDP and development that's led through, so for example, the market or whatever. So a philosopher like Thomas Poga, who complains about the obsession of economists with growth and therefore missing things, or the activist criticisms of the Washington Consensus and whatnot, is that they, in some sense, are just their moral outrage turns into a demand for a planner on the other side.
Yeah.
Right. As opposed to this point that you're making at all. And I was wondering, you know, this issue about, I mean, you've been dealing with this for a long time, the tyranny of experts, but it's quite a fascinating aspect about how you thread the needle between both being a critic of expertise, a critic of this obsession with growth, but not falling onto the other side of wanting to have expert reformers, but from the other moral side of things. How did you negotiate that in your own mind as you were going through this?
That's the other big debate between Condorcet and Smith, is the role of experts. Condorcet is saying, you know, just that's another way to assure well-being, is just put the experts in charge. I should say put us experts in charge.
Yeah.
Condorcet was part of the French physiocrats who very much saw themselves as experts bringing, you know, economic development to places that they were conquering, or places they were advising at home. And Smith was saying, no, 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 you know, first of all, he didn't think material development even happened as a result of experts. But again, that's not the core debate. The core debate was, if the experts are forcing their regime on those that they are supposedly benefiting, Smith disputes that. He says, no, you're not making them better off. You're forcing them to take it, you know. And we can see here the origins of really kind of liberal skepticism, which I think is the key. Yeah. Smith is saying, you know, if you experts are advising those with unlimited power to impose your expert views, you know, that's not a great situation. He's skeptical that you can trust those in power and their expert advisors to actually be benevolent, act in someone else's interest, rather than what Smith thought more obvious, they would act in their own interest, not in someone else's interest. So he saw the colonizing of India, of North and South America, as, you know, the colonizers engaging in just plunder, despite the veneer of expert, you know, advice that all this was happening with. So ironically, I think there's kind of almost a convergence between the right and the left on that, wanting the experts to be in charge. They just want different experts to be in charge.
Yeah.
Where there's like a third alternative that Smith is presenting, that you don't have the experts in charge. You don't have unlimited power for the experts.
Yeah. In your discussion of these ideas, there's a couple of things that really stand out. One of them is what you said already, which is that the determinative factor in Smith's judgment was not whether or not material progress happened or not. To most economists, the material progress is the point, right? Trying to explain. And to Smith, even if you could have material progress, but it came at the expense of the freedom and dignity of the individuals, then it wasn't to be deemed as better.
So I think this is another kind of important liberal skepticism that was brought by Smith and his successors like John Stuart Mill and Benjamin Conquest and so on. He's saying his skepticism was like, if what you're doing to these people is really so good for them, why do you have to force them to take it?
Yeah.
Why is force necessary to get them to take your benevolence?
Yeah.
That again goes to his enshrining of consent as a determinative principle.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't consent, well, and you have to force them through extreme violence of conquest and slavery to take it, you know, why do you think that violence is necessary if it's so good for them? This also was the way in which Smith and later Mill entered the slavery debate. You know, slave owners claimed to bring material benefits to the slaves, and Smith said, oh, yeah, that could have been possible compared to, you know, the people in Africa that were not enslaved or compared to the British working class. It's possible that there could have been material increases in income compared to those control groups. But again, for Smith, that's not a determinative question. The obvious use of force is, again, why, if you're so good for your slaves, why do you have to enslave them? Why do you have to force them to take the benevolence? And for that matter, if slavery is so great, why don't you want it for yourself? You slave owners show by your own choices that slavery is not great.
Yeah. The second part that I was going to raise there is that in this discussion, you also talk about, you mentioned it earlier, that Smith doesn't even see the emergence of the institutions of natural liberty as arising from experts. They arise, as he says, you know, not due to any human wisdom, right? Or overarching, you know, and you quote him on that. And in modern development economics, you know, so after, let's say, the elusive quest for growth, and where you go through all the different explanations and why it is that they don't work out, right? Population control, you know, Big Bang, all these different things like that. Since that time, one of the major issues has been the rise of state capacity theories of development. Yeah. That somehow what we need to do is just make sure that the government of those economies is effective enough that it can provide the right amount of public goods and all kinds of issues like that. Think about the Acemoglu and Robinson book on the narrow corridor. There needs to be some state that's, you know, constrained at some level by society, but it has to be a big state and a big society rather than the smaller ones. And I was wondering if you could comment on this whole rise of state capacity development theory and what you're identifying, because on the one hand, there is a correlation between the enforcement of property rights and the ability to both protect persons and property as well as have voluntary exchange. And you need someone to protect the property rights. But at the same time, the state capacity can go the other way too, right? So I was just wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, that's where the faith in experts sort of shades into the issue of what is the state capable of doing for developing a society? And, you know, of course, as this Smith view of spontaneous development was later developed by Hayek, the key problem is there's just not enough information at the top.
Right.
So there's an issue of information and there's an issue of capability, which we're talking about. Do you have enough information? And even if you did, do you have the capacity to implement it, you know, wisely? That again leads back to the liberal skepticism that a powerful state is going to act in its own interest. The leader, the ruler is going to act in his own interest and not in the interest of the population. So I think we see there the core thing is this liberal critique, which really doubts the ability of planners at the top, whether it be the experts saying what to do or the state rulers trying to implement that expert advice, is doubting that capacity to achieve anything. But, you know, it's not just about whether they succeed or not in achieving the material GDP increase. Again, it's also, you know, how do you define what achievement is?
Yeah.
How do you define what really makes people better off? And for Smith and the classical liberals, that's defined by what people choose for themselves. That's really, in my more recent passion, that's really the central thing. Not what I was working on for most of my career, you know, what led to material GDP growth or not.
Right.
That's also extremely important, obviously, and that's correctly what we should spend a lot of the debate on. But even if we resolve that, there's still the bigger doubt. You know, do the experts and the rulers, can they be trusted to benefit people? Do they even know what benefits people if they don't give people the right to choose for themselves?
Yeah. Your discussion of this criticism that Smith has, really anticipates so much of modern political economy, because you point out that not only did Smith understand that they didn't lack the knowledge, you know, and they in fact suffered from a fatal conceit, as Hayek would put it, but also that it's silly to assume that you have a benevolent autocrat, right? Because right. They're going to actually rule not in the interest of the people, but in the interest of themselves. And so I think it's really, really great there.
I wanted to interject something.
Yeah.
I mean, the examples are sort of Paul Kagame in Rwanda, that's thought to be this benevolent guy, you know, really cleaning up Rwanda, keeping the streets clean, bringing GDP growth. But at the same time, he's, you know, been accused some evidence of engaging in a regime of assassinations of his opponents all over the place.
Yeah.
Or take Millicent Awi of Ethiopia, who was in power from the early 90s through 2012 when he died of natural causes. You know, he was celebrated by people like Bill Gates as a benevolent autocrat. And there was rapid GDP growth in Ethiopia over this period. Yet he's, you know, torturing, imprisoning political prisoners, forcing farmers to move at gunpoint from their own lands to some other state-approved planned land development, which, you know, they don't want. Again, it always comes back to the same thing. You know, can you trust these rulers with the absolute power to actually act in the benefit of their citizens? And second, you know, how do you know what the benefit is unless you give the citizens the freedom of choice to be in charge of their own development?
Yeah, that freedom of choice aspect of your that you stress is I think comes through from page one to the last page. So it's really quite important. The it's in development economics is an interesting thing. You know, in the beginning, as you know, Smith says that all you need to go from the lowest levels to the highest levels of opulence is peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. And so that means that they have to have some kind of these institutions. But I'm always reminded of your friend Lant Pritchard in one of his books in development economics starts with a quote from Yogi Berra. When Yogi Berra was the baseball manager, one of the rookies was trying to imitate Frank Robinson's stance in hitting because Frank Robinson had won the Triple Crown the year before. And Yogi said to him, if I get this quote right, you can't imitate him unless you can copy him. And in a lot of, you know, development economics, we're supposed to find these particular examples independent of any of the cultural, historical context and just sort of plop them, these institutions, wherever we want. And that was the way in which institutions came back into development. But there's something fundamentally wrong with that picture, correct?
Totally. Yeah. The feeling that you can just sort of parachute a perfect society into somewhere else with very different historical conditions is kind of part of the delusion of the experts.
Yeah, we saw that a lot in East and Central Europe after the collapse of communism.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Like, eloquently about that. And I was there as a junior World Bank economist, at first very confident that we knew what to tell Russia.
Yeah.
And that this place would be booming in no time and everyone would be better off.
Yeah, one size fits all.
It was the worst recession in economic history and led to the rise of Putin and all that. And of course, you know, the other big one is China that's so celebrated because of rapid GDP growth. But, you know, first of all, that did happen in a more gradual way with the emergence of markets, which got credit for the initial phases of that GDP growth. The second, once again, you know, if you have to force this development on the Chinese citizens, is it really making them better off?
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question about economics as a discipline in some sense, because like you mentioned earlier, this is the 250th anniversary of the Wealth of Nations.
Yeah.
So it's not like we've been at this for just a few years. And the earlier economists did, like you point out, Adam Smith, at least it was part of the conversation that questions about consent And as you put it so eloquently in your book, agency, right? This is a big issue, agency and dignity. Why do you think that in the 20th century, economists turned such a blind eye to those questions, especially in the period when you move from colonialism to post-colonialism? It's still nevertheless a blind eye towards those issues.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned agency and dignity. I think that's kind of the big thing that discriminates between classical economics and modern economics, is the classical economists saw that there was sort of a demand for self-determination, for choice, for being in charge of yourself. You know, Smith is very big about being in charge of yourself and not having someone else in charge of you. And, you know, it's not fully developed in Smith, but there's emerging this idea that there's a demand for making your own choices, for self-determination. And that's, you know, what's really absent from economics, beginning with the post-classical generation with Alfred Marshall, that, you know, no longer sort of sees any demand for the choice, no longer sees a sort of a moral question about whether you give choice or deny choice. It's now all, once again, as Condorcet would have wanted, all about material GDP and what raises material GDP. Now, I should say, to be fair to the other side, you know, there are some good reasons for wanting to avoid a moral debate. You're worried that the other, your opponents will also engage in moralizing, which they definitely do. So the proponents of energetic state action are often, you know, giving their own moral objections, yeah, to something like high inequality and justifying in that way. And so you get sort of a moral debate that it's hard to see how it would ever be resolved between sort of the left wanting, you know, forcible decreases in inequality and the liberal, classical liberals wanting more freedom as an end in itself. But I think the illusion is that you could have an economic debate that would be completely free of moral values. And you could argue that it would be progress if both sides could acknowledge that they are pursuing their own moral values, which may not be shared by the other side. And that would be a big, healthy kind of reform of the current debate, is to acknowledge differences in goals as well as differences in how you achieve those goals.
Yeah, so it's an intimate relationship between liberal pluralism and basically economic freedom and development.
Right.
Yeah. So there have been economists, Amartya Sen being among them, in modern times. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the relationship you see between your argument and the one that Sen develops in Development as Freedom?
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that Sen was actually a student of P.T. Bauer, and said very nice things about P.T. Bauer, even though Sen is more associated with the left and P.T. Bauer with the right. And you can think of P.T. Bauer as the first one in kind of the modern generation of development who tried to make freedom an end in itself, was unsuccessful. And you could think of Milton Friedman as being very much in that tradition. And then Sen comes along. Sen doesn't like to quote Friedman. I don't think he ever did, to my knowledge. But he does say nice things about P.T. Bauer. And, you know, Sen's book, Development as Freedom, is very much trying to sell the case that freedom is an end in itself and that markets. And, you know, this is the other important point, of course, with the classical liberals, that markets are kind of the most obvious way to allow freedom of choice. And what's nice about markets is you allow freedom of choice to both sides of a transaction, and the transaction then becomes a positive-sum game, which both sides benefit. And Sen was very much making that argument in the book Development as Freedom, that markets should be seen not only as a possible ingredient of material development, but also making possible this goal of freedom. Yeah. Of course, the sad thing is that neither P.T. Bauer nor Milton Friedman nor Amartya Sen were actually successful in getting the development world to take on freedom as an end in itself.
Yeah.
So I should feel kind of worried about that. My enormous betters in the intellectual tradition failed. You know, how do I think I'm going to have any effect trying to persuade people in this direction? Probably not.
Well, it's interesting, even, you know, with those people, you know, not so much P.T. Bauer, but clearly, you know, Friedman has been tagged, you know, fairly or unfairly with Pinochet and the problem of that. And Sen is caught up in many ways in the capabilities approach, which is one in which argues not necessarily for no expertise, but experts to make sure that everyone has the same human capabilities or whatever. I mean, that would be like more like Martha Nussbaum, who worked with him on the UN or whatever, and trying to create those things. And so there's a, it's a complicated literature, right? I mean, it's yeah. You have to sort out between a lot of different things.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think I agree with you. Friedman was unfairly accused of kind of, yeah. you know, being on the side of Pinochet, when in fact, almost every development economist in history everywhere since the
1950s
has been advising autocrats all the time. So why Friedman should be singled out on that is really unclear. But we do have to acknowledge there is kind of this classical liberal temptation, which is to sort of, if you have like a free market autocrat, you're really tempted to, you know, kind of support them parachuting in the right institutions and the right policies into another society. And John Stuart Mill struggled with that also. I mean, on slavery, he was very clear that he wanted people to choose for themselves. But on India, which of course he was involved in as working with the East India Company, he saw this need for some kind of colonial benevolent despotism. I think that is always a perpetual temptation. You know, if we can get the classical liberal rules implemented by a colonial autocrat or a domestic autocrat, it's kind of tempting to support that because it seems like a nice shortcut to getting where you want to go. But again, the problem, of course, becomes, first of all, it's going to be a huge backlash. You know, colonialism fell. Pinochet fell from power, was rejected by the electorate when there finally was an election. And that backlash really is kind of toxic for the classical liberal ideals.
Right.
In Chile, part of the reason why the regimes moved away from those ideals had something to do with this backlash against Pinochet and the association of him with free market policies.
I think you can see that in the earlier period of time, reaction in Argentina against Menem, and in East and Central Europe, you have, you know, people. I mean, I've always been struck by the fact that, you know, if you go back in history and you look at when Putin first rose, people would talk about how Putin was actually had liberal tendencies, yeah. or Viktor Orban, you know, they had that, or in Turkey, Erdogan was also viewed in that way. In India, most recently, Modi was sort of this. And then with them, they came all this sort of more authoritarianism out of this idea. And so it's a kind of a very interesting interrelationship between economics and politics in that regard. Yeah. And
I was wondering, the liberal skepticism again, can, even if these guys are being supposedly benevolent right now, can you trust them to remain benevolent when they have absolute power and they want to act in their own interest? So, you know, classical liberals would say no. But again, it's tricky because you really are tempted to support some autocrat who's seemingly doing the right things.
What, when you were writing the book and doing the research for it, what were some of the biggest, you know, surprises in illustrating your point that you came across? I mean, on the one hand, you know, the violence of a King Leopold is not, you know, we all kind of know about that in the Congo or whatever, but how about other examples that you came across and where people are trying to impose with an iron fist and, you know, trying to get development versus the idea of, or even with a velvet fist that turns into an iron fist, you know, what were some of the telling stories that you would like to highlight?
I think the biggest one that was kind of a new thing for me was how much sort of Native American, American Indian development was justified by the white ruling class in the colonies, that there was a democracy for European people of European origin, but not for Native Americans. This was very much used to justify conquest, beginning with John Winthrop in Massachusetts in the 1600s, who say, you know, they'd be happy to give up their land once they see all the agricultural knowledge that we're bringing them, so they'll make even more from their remaining land than they would have from all the land if we take away some of their land and bring them the agricultural advice. And then, you know, led down the years to an attempt to develop the Creek Indians in the early 1800s, and the Cherokees around the same time. And Cherokee development, interesting, was arguably somewhat successful. And so you could say, oh, maybe this really is benevolent. But of course, where did it lead? It led to a drastic Indian removal west of the Mississippi, the Trail of Tears for the Creeks and the Cherokees. So again, once you give someone else the absolute power to act for your benevolence, you also give them the power to act in their own interest in ways that's definitely obviously not benevolent.
I think that part of your book is very, you know, enlightening and moving at the same time. You know, you highlight the fact that they justified this in terms of saying that the Native Americans were welcoming this. They were asking for it, right?
Yeah.
And so it, at that level, it's a voluntary, they're trying to convey it as voluntary.
Right.
You know, please come in here and eradicate my society, basically.
Right. Right.
And so I think you tell that story really in a compelling way. I wanted to go back to something you talked about in terms of the debate that took place, because there is a kind of an interesting transformation from the time of Smith to the time of Mill and then Marshall, which is that when Smith is writing, it's quite clear that the natural state of mankind is poverty. Mm-hmm. And the thing that needs to be explained is wealth creation,
mm-hmm.
right? But by the time we experience the tremendous advance in material goods and production between the 18th century through to the 19th century, there now becomes a new puzzle, which is how do we have poverty amidst all this plenty?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to try to figure out ways to solve that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you thought that shift in perspective, where they move from a one where you're trying to create understand how it is that individuals can escape subsistence, to how it is that we can address the social problems of poverty, ignorance, squalor, disease, and idleness,
mm-hmm.
through, you know, changes the nature of the conversation that we see in development economics.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the Industrial Revolution in the European countries led to even more self-confidence among the European colonizers, that they knew what to do in the colonies to bring colonies to economic development.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing Condorcet was so confident when actually, you know, France at that time was not doing that great, and soon spiraled downward into the revolution. And, you know, by a century later with Alfred Marshall has seen, you know, a huge amount of development happen in Britain and Western Europe and America. And, you know, now he's even more confident that we should force our great expert advice on recipients, because it seems like Europeans know what to do. Again, the problem is, you know, do you really know what to do if you have to force people to take it? Why aren't those people willing to take it if it's supposed to be for their own good?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you know, eventually it led to this very forceful rejection of colonialism. Even when independence led to better material outcomes or worse material outcomes, the support for colonialism ending was the same. When the economy went down after independence, there was no movement to go like, oh, we bring back the colonizers. That's never happened. Because, again, people seem to have a fierce demand for self-determination, for ruling themselves. And they don't like an idea that involves, you know, well, there's this other group that alone has the secrets to wisdom, how to achieve development. This other group is superior to your group. Your group is not capable of ruling yourselves for your own good. We need to have us impose by force our great deal of how we're superior to you and offer you our superior wisdom. You know, not surprisingly, that view of the world is not popular with those who are on the end of the scale being patronized and insulted.
You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting, you mentioned about Bauer and others having problems winning the day in an argument, but the reality is that they were sort of arguing for a liberal approach, but somehow liberalism got blamed for the non-liberal approach,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
So we see this in post-colonialism,
yeah,
in which the reaction is not, oh, let's have a true liberal you know, development. It's let's have a socialist planning development. And I think that you see a similar thing in the rejection of the Washington Consensus. All of the same criticisms come about you know, self-determination and the criticisms. But the answer and response is not to embrace liberalism, but instead to embrace some kind of other form of statism and socialism. And it just seems like it's repeating itself. Maybe I'm overstating that, but it seems to repeat itself over and over again. I was wondering your reaction to that.
Yeah, I think one of the big intellectual tragedies of the 20th century, you know, around development is that the socialists captured the anti-colonial movement. And the classical liberals largely failed to make inroads in the anti-colonial movement, with some exceptions. You know, there's some liberal thinkers among the colonial peoples.
Yeah.
You know, fairly obscure ones like Carlos Romulo in the Philippines. And I think, and this capture of the anti-colonial movement began with Lenin right away. You know, he was able to kind of mock and insult the imperialists by, you know, I'm making obvious they were acting in their own self-interest and offering kind of state violence as a way to assert self-determination, as opposed to just building a liberal society where individuals would be free to determine themselves as well as collectively free to determine their regime with the consent of the governed. And so, again, Lenin is sort of offering what seems like a big shortcut. You know, here you can just engage in massive violence. And he offers you this sort of attractive reversal that now the proletariat is going to be the ones in charge and be on top. And the bourgeoisie is going to be on the bottom. So, you know, you think of that as a reversal from the colonial mindset where the rich whites are on top and the poor non-white subjects are on the bottom. Yeah. Well, Lenin had a very appealing message, especially to those, you know, anti-colonial intellectuals who would themselves be in charge under a Leninist regime of absolute power. That's, of course, also attractive to them directly. And so, you know, it's very sad that happened and still happens today, that the movements for self-determination often involve a lot of violence, like the Taliban in Afghanistan. And, you know, it's sad that, you know, the U.S. is not to blame for the Taliban, but the way that Americans were in charge of Afghanistan for 20 years definitely had something to do with the Taliban's ability to kind of gain some support from key parts of the population to overthrow the Americans.
Yeah. I'm wondering if we I get your reaction to this sort of question, which is that in order to actually get agency and dignity accorded to each individual, that we are in fact one another's dignified equals, mm-hmm. that we need to have a very robust notion of self-governance, mm-hmm. Rather than the idea that we need to have even like this idea of a strong, you know, minimal state, let's say. Say we talk about the state being minimal in its scope and scale, but it has to be really strong, one of which is militarism, which is what you were just talking about, right? Like we try to export supposedly free markets and democracy to Afghanistan. And instead, what we did was created a counter-reaction, which is to have a society that doesn't accord dignity and respect to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I think the really hard problem for classical liberals is the relationship between kind of collective self-determination and individual self-determination. Yeah. And, you know, liberals want to find a way to do both, to try to reconcile both at the same time, which is not an easy problem. Whereas both the socialists and the imperialists are happy with, you know, just violating the individual rights, and the socialists do it to assert collective self-determination, and the imperialist militarists do it sort of not caring about collective self-determination. So the militarists sort of violate both collective self-determination and individual self-determination in places like Afghanistan, where there's definitely not the regime of individual rights. And then the anti-liberal, violent, evil people like the Taliban and sort of capture the mantra of collective self-determination, even while they are also violating individual self-determination. Yeah. So it's like the militarists and the socialists, the violent revolutionaries sort of agree on violating individual self-determination. They just disagree on collective self-determination. And that, of course, leads the Western actors to be very vulnerable to the charge that they're very hypocritical. They don't care about the freedom of the peoples that they're conquering.
So do you think that the reason why liberals have had such a difficulty getting their position across is because they haven't figured out a way to resolve this tension between individual self-determination and collective self-determination? I mean, would you put that as the silver bullet in some sense that needs to be, solved? I mean, it's kind of a future research question.
There are no silver bullets, of course, but now. I mean, I think it's more... I mean, yes, it's a very hard problem to solve, and you eventually try to get to some kind of liberal democracy in which the majority has a voice, but they're also constrained on what they can do to individuals. And that constraint also has to be agreed on at some point by this consent of the governed. So it's not an easy problem to solve. But I think it's more that just the hypocrisy of really not caring even about individual freedom. I mean, for example, at the time of the Versailles Conference in 19 after World War I, Woodrow Wilson showed no interest whatsoever in this very pervasive problem of forced labor that had been happening in Africa, like most notoriously in the Congo under King Leopold. And so he could have sort of outflanked Lenin at that point by saying, at least the West offers a regime which would be individual kind of freedom of labor. Consent to your own labor, whereas, the colonizers were engaging in widespread forced labor, and Woodrow Wilson just didn't care about that. So he lost the battle on freedom before it even began. And that has something to do with Wilson being very much in the Alfred Marshall School, where you don't really care about the issue of consent and freedom. It's a moral issue.
Well, it's the rule by experts, right? So, in this book, more than even in your other books, I would say you're sort of forced to deal with some rather deep philosophical issues having to do with what the nature of agency is, and or the way you would put it, the nature of what it means to choose freely, according dignity to each and every individual. There's some real fundamental puzzles, right, that are involved in achieving this stuff. Like, for example, what Popper calls the paradox of toleration, right? Because that seems to be an issue that is being debated very, very vociferously right now across the world. And do you have any thoughts on those kind of issues after doing all the research on this book?
I think the key thing is that the classical liberals, both historically and still today, they're much better on being skeptical of obvious violations of consent, obvious use of force and violence to achieve development. They're much better being skeptical about that and making a huge contribution by challenging that view. They're better at that than they are providing some kind of blueprint of what to do instead.
Yeah.
And arguably, it's sort of consistent with Adam Smith's concept of not relying on the experts. If the experts knew what to do, then maybe you would have more faith in putting them in charge. But again, I think it's sort of beginning with Adam Smith up to the present day, the liberals that just say, frankly, we don't know what to do. We don't know what the blueprint is. But you could at least end these more obvious forms of violence. You don't have to invade other countries in the name of development in the modern period, like Afghanistan or today, Venezuela or Greenland. Take away those most obvious forms of violence and compulsion, and that's already progress.
Yeah, I mean, there's a low-hanging fruit bar, right? Yeah, which is absolutely. A friend of mine wrote actually a New York Times bestseller. We were college buddies together. His name is Matt Kibbe. He wrote a book. It's called Don't Hurt People and Don't Take Their Stuff. So there is a kind of low-hanging bar that we need to do. But I was just wondering.
But a lot of progress happens that way, right? I
mean, sure.
Slavery is low-hanging fruit, but ending slavery is pretty important. Colonialism was sort of low-hanging fruit, but ending that kind of violence in the name of development was something that a lot of people wanted, and that happened. So you could argue that we economists, liberal experts, are a lot more useful doing that than we are trying to come up with our own plan for how to do everything.
I very much like that aspect of, you know, when you're, it starts in the beginning of the book with the contrast between Smith and Condorcet, that Smith says not only is he a critic of the effort to impose, but he has no desire to impose himself.
Yeah,
that's right. Really and I think that's a big leap to make, because a lot of people, once they diagnose the errors of something, then have their idea of what my fix would be, the better fix. So why not do that?
There are very few economists that can meet that Adam Smith standard of being self-denying.
I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit about that with respect to public policy in general. It sort of relates to what you just said. Maybe, you know, the abolitionist movement is the model in many ways for, you know, thinking about these things. So, you know, or the free trade movement, you know, with Cobden and Bright, which is that what you want to do is not so much impose, but get rid of the restrictions, you know, or get rid of the violations. How do you think about that in public policy in general?
Yeah, I mean, Frederick Douglass kind of, you know, quoted the British abolitionist movement about slavery, just saying, you know, I don't have a plan for what's going to happen after the end of slavery. I don't need to have a plan in order to abolish slavery.
Yeah.
You know, the slavery is just an issue of sort of stop stealing, was his quote from the British abolitionist. And so, you know, even after the Civil War, Douglass is very skeptical about the philanthropic efforts to help the ex-slaves. He said, you know, why do you have these kind of incompetent white experts coming from the North to the South trying to do good things? You know, why not put the people from the enslaved communities in charge of their own development? So I think that very much leaks into the modern debate that you don't have to have like a comprehensive plan for what's going to happen after you end some form of violence or compulsion. You just end the violence.
Yeah.
And that's a step forward.
That's a lesson, I think, that we might also take away from our more recent experience with, you know, in East and Central Europe, because there was all kinds of designs, how to privatize for what goal, to maximize revenue in some lens, right? That's a selling off kind of idea, as opposed to simply, you know, creating conditions of freedom of entry and trade, you know? So this comes back to another question I wanted to ask you about with respect to, you know, is the main sort of development model just simply the freedom to exchange goods and services and for people to vote with their feet across various areas so that we end up by having, you know, individuals migrate to where they think is the best for them to live and whatnot? I mean, what do you think about that?
Of course, I'm in favor of as much freedom of markets as possible domestically in every country, which seems like kind of the easiest way to achieve some kind of individual freedom in a mutually beneficial way. Freedom of migration is kind of a harder thing. I would very much, you know, certainly in general be in favor of free migration. It seems like, you know, a lot of individuals choose a place where they want to live. That seems like another form of individual freedom. But of course, the problem has been in the recipient societies, you know, is what kind of consent do you allow for whether recipient societies receive the migrants or not?
Yeah.
And, you know, most countries in the world do not have open borders, including countries, you know, inhabited by peoples that the advocates of immigration want to have freedom of migration. In the home countries of all the migrant groups, the home countries are also not allowing freedom of migration into their own country. So there seems to be some big you know, stumbling block that a lot of populations around the world don't want freedom of immigration. And what do economists do about that? You know, I mean, it's, you could morally oppose those immigration restrictions, but, you know, you still have to struggle with some idea of the consent of the governed and the recipient countries. It's not an easy matter to resolve. You can't just wish it away.
I mean, it seems like it's become a major pressure point in democratic societies in the West at the moment, and maybe the issue having to do with the democratic backsliding. I happen to be someone who's very favorable towards open borders and the moral aspect of that, because it's both the moral of the people who they should have the freedom to decide where they want to live their lives and whatnot, but also the individuals here who should be freely able to contract with people that they want to interact with. But I understand that there's very strong pressure points, as we see not only in the United States, but also in the Nordic countries and other places where they you know, you've seen this kind of, you know, very strong reaction in societies, and therefore the rise of somewhat of unsavory nationalism, you know, emerging. But again, I going back to like your point about colonialism and post-colonialism, there does seem to always be a reaction, counter-reaction kind of idea, you know? And so the fact that we decided to try to, you know, to, in the Middle East, to export democracy at the point of a gun meant that, you know, sometimes people might not like democracy having a gun pointed at them, right? And so they end up by rejecting it and going the other way.
Right.
So you've written this series of books in the field of development economics. You mentioned critics everywhere from Adam Smith in the old days to P.T. Bauer to Amartya Sen, even raising issues. Do you have, like, what would be your grounds for hope that the discipline itself will somewhat shift away from this notion of technical expertise to one in which, let's say, we don't get rid of expertise, but we have expertise constrained by, you know, an emphasis on the moral imagination? Or do you think that that is just not going to happen given what we decide as science and acceptable answers and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, again, what would be the grounds for hope when, 100 years of economists arguing for this, freedom as one in itself has, you know, been unsuccessful in reforming the economics profession. I mean, the good news is increases in freedom did happen anyway. So economists are sort of perpetually not really caring about freedom, and yet then after the fact having to sort of catch up with new forms of liberation, of increased freedom have happened, you know, through the rise of international trade, or through the end of colonialism, or, you know, the end of apartheid, or whatever. So that, I think that's the good news. That's the ground for hope, that even if economists don't care enough about freedom, people do care about their own freedom.
Yeah.
They care about their own agency and dignity and self-determination. So, you know, economists eventually have to kind of come around to that after it's already happened. But the faith in economists kind of leading the charge for freedom, I think, was not very well grounded.
I mean, that's last point that you make is an interesting one. It also goes back to, you know, Adam Smith and something that you captured there as well in his examples, because of like the butcher, the baker, and the brewer and whatnot, is because he didn't orchestrate that. Economists didn't orchestrate that. That was already human beings who did that. And then he's trying to understand it, right? There's a difference. There's a great old book by David Kolander called Why Economists Are Not as Important as Garbage Men. And he starts with a thought experiment. Imagine if all the garbage men in New York City went on strike, and then compare how disruptive that would be for our life if all the economists decided to go on strike in New York, right? It wouldn't be that disruptive. And I also think, besides that aspect of the forces of hope, I think that your own career is an example of why young economists should have hope, right? Because as you pointed out, you know, you were a traditional development economist. And then, you know, your position evolved as you confronted reality. And it wasn't like you were a methodological critic from the beginning or an ideological critic from the beginning of the development exercise. But you've come to change your views on things over these years. Don't you see that as a path that is also very good reason for hope?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I should be a reason for hope or a cautionary tale and whatnot. You know, I mean, I think I'll immodestly say when sort of the main thing I was doing was casting skepticism on whether aid really did achieve material development or not. I think that I succeeded getting some attention for that argument, convincing a few people. When I got more interested in kind of shifting the debate onto the moral grounds of, like, is development, you know, actually being based on the rights of the people being developed, on the rights of poor people, you know, have we forgotten about the rights of poor people?
Yeah.
And should the aim of development be to promote those rights as well as promoting material development? I feel like that it's been tremendously harder to make any progress on that debate. And I think, you know, if young people were acting purely in their own self-interest, I advise them to stick to talking about material GDP growth and don't talk so much about freedom as an end in itself, because lots of people have failed to make progress on that before you.
Yeah.
But still, you know, there's always this kind of movie romanticism that the most noble people are those, the heroes who kind of fight against enormous odds and maybe even, you know, to their inevitable doom, but still leave a heritage of fighting against enormous odds to future generations. You know, that may be a movie historical quest of the hero for freedom against enormous odds. I think maybe that could be appealing to some people as a way to go.
Well, I want to congratulate you on this book. I think it's, you know, one of the most important books published in the last several years. And I will do the best I can as a teacher to make sure that people are exposed to your positions. And I do think that individuals like yourself, your friend Lant Pritchard, other people, my colleague Michael Clemens, they are all doing tremendous work that leads us and gives us hope that we can learn from these careful studies ways to have a more humane and just society. So I want to thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.